If you like what you hear on the Security Ledger podcast, you might want to check out one of our cybersecurity newsletters like the Daily Ledger or the Weekly Ledger. You can sign up for them at securityledger.com/subscribe. Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's episode, number 82, the EU General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, takes effect in a few months, but many companies in North America and Europe are unprepared to meet the law's strict new requirements. In this week's episode, we'll talk with two experts about what GDPR has in store for companies and what they can do to get ready for it. Sam Feifel of the International Association of Privacy Professionals and Shane Nolan of IDA, the Irish Development Authority, will join us in the studio. But first, attacks on Internet of Things devices are becoming more and more common and more dangerous. 2018 may bring even more of that type of action, especially after the publication of a new tool dubbed Autosploit that makes finding and hacking into embedded devices as easy as clicking a button. The new tool, which was published to the open source code repository GitHub last week, marries a number of existing tools like the Shodan search engine and the Metasploit attack platform in one easy-to-use tool. Our first guest, Brian Knopp of the firm Neustar, says that Autosploit's blending of those tools isn't new, but that it will lower the bar substantially for anyone wishing to attack Internet of Things endpoints online.
Brian Knopp, and I'm Senior Director of Security Research and IoT Architect at Neustar. You know, Autosploit takes Shodan and Metasploit and puts it together. And for those not familiar with Shodan, Shodan is a search engine that a lot of security researchers use to find devices once they find vulnerabilities, so they can get a sense of account of how many there are.
Kind of like Google for hardware, basically.
Exactly. And so you can look for, you know, specific ports for a device or headers that come up on a device so you can find how many are out there. So researchers have been using the data from Shodan and then exploiting via Metasploit for different things for a long time, obviously for things that they have access to. But what Autosploit's doing is it puts it together so that it's lowering the bar for how to use it. Now, it's not so much the tool that's the problem. They do make it extremely easy. It even has a Docker image, so you don't have to install everything in a complicated way. You just install Docker and then you install the Docker image and you're ready to go. So it just makes it easy for people who are less skilled at security to use these tools to execute attacks.
You know, Metasploit is a really common kind of penetration testing tool. What types of exploits are out there in Metasploit for, let's say, Internet of Things or industrial control?
Metasploit has released a number of modules and they also get submissions from the community for IoT devices. But remember that IoT devices are really just servers, right? They run web servers. They've got Linux-based operating systems. So many of the existing modules for Metasploit already worked on IoT devices. It's just that now that they're creating very specific ones to help, you know, with IoT devices as well. They can exploit all kinds of things, problems in the web servers on them, API injections, command line injections, loading things into memory, all kinds of stuff.
And we've seen we've often seen, and I think there was some news this week also, that some of these web server modules are used commonly across many different devices, even by different manufacturers, or kind of third-party components that are thrown in there. So these vulnerabilities or Metasploit modules that target these web server components, these could impact just hundreds of thousands of different devices.
Yeah, I'll give a great example. When the UPnP vulnerability came up a number of years ago, it was a library that was used by millions of devices, vendors all across the spectrum. There were very few IoT or connected device vendors that it did not affect. And so this is, you know, when you're building these devices, you have low margin. So one of the things that vendors like to do is use third-party libraries rather than build, you know, a new library to do a specific feature like keep a connection or find devices on a network. They look for a library that already has it. And so when you compromise something in that library, chances are it's being used by millions of devices.
Okay, so if you're a stereotypical pimply-faced script kiddie in your mom's basement, what can you do as a result of Autosploit being released, maybe that you couldn't do or couldn't easily do before?
If we're talking about script kiddies, people who understand, you know, they grab these tools, they don't really understand the security behind it. They're just sort of point and shoot. Before, they were just firing at everything. And what this sort of allows them to do is target things based on Shodan that are high volume devices. So whereas before, they might find an exploit on a device and there's only 1,000 of them on the internet. Now they can look for things that are, you know, 50,000 devices and go after those. So it sort of focuses a script kiddie a little more. Now, obviously, other people can use this, right? Researchers can use this as well. But it just brings those two things together rather than having to do that connection yourself and say, okay, if I'm looking to find network video recorders, in the case of Mirai, that have, you know, Telnet open, you go do a search in Shodan for a specific port, right? Or a specific header. Well, now you can find those that are, there are far more of them.
So in your previous life, you developed products for Belkin as well as Linksys. So two pretty prominent embedded system makers, make home routers and Wi-Fi hotspots. What, if you can't stop the creation of tools, because of course tools themselves aren't illegal, what is the best way to limit the potential damage of a tool like Autosploit?
So I think the biggest issue is that there's zero regulation around connected devices. Now, when I was at Belkin and we then acquired Linksys from Cisco, we built Internet of Things devices, and we also built routers for the consumer and for small, medium business. So a very large range of types of devices, but the overwhelming problem that we faced, you know, from a security perspective was how much could we spend on security to solve problems on these devices? And how long could we support these devices? You know, how many years of updates would we have? And this is a challenge that I think regulation might not be our best route, but it's a start. I think consumers leveraging their buying power and looking at manufacturers that actually, you know, you can go to their sites and they'll have a security page if they take security seriously. They may have bug bounty programs. Those are the kind of vendors that you should be looking at if you're going to buy these devices, because you know they're going to update them. You know they're taking it seriously rather than just sort of burying their head in the sand and ignoring it.
Yeah, I mean, I like to say that, you know, a lot of device makers, whether it's, you know, webcams or what have you, are more or less following the Bic Lighter business model, right? Which is, you know, we don't manage this thing. We're not going to support it. It costs $40. You buy it and you get whatever software comes on it. And more or less from our standpoint, that's it. But that causes a huge problem in the environment of the internet, because you have all these vulnerable devices out there that can then be compromised and harnessed, right?
Yeah, and there's another issue at play, which is the way that these devices are built. So very much the way that Android was built originally, you have what are called original development manufacturers and joint development manufacturers. And the difference really there is who builds the firmware and the software. And so if you take many of the vendors, right, Linksys, Belkin, Netgear, Asus, most of those vendors have two lines of products. Some are original development manufacturer products, which means the hardware manufacturer builds the whole thing, the firmware, the software, the hardware. The vendor who's selling it gives them graphics so that it has like the Asus logo or the Linksys logo. But all in all, it's a product that they didn't build. Mm-hmm. And what you end up getting is the same vulnerability across all these vendors' products, because they just used essentially a white label version of a product. Now, in the joint development, you get the actual, you know, Linksys or Belkin or Asus building the firmware, part of the firmware. And then you get the manufacturer, you know, the ODM or JDM in this case, who still builds the hardware. But you also have a software development kit from the chipset manufacturer, right? So your Intels, your Qualcomms, your Broadcoms. You then have the what we call the board support package. And interesting enough, these are a lot of times where the exploits exist. These are tools that are used to program the serial number, program the MAC address, do things off the assembly line to validate that the device is set up properly. And then you have what the selling vendor puts on top of that. So depending where that vulnerability exists, the way to fix it can take a long time. Now, in addition to that, you also have these third-party libraries I talked about, things like, you know, mini UPnP. And a lot of times those libraries are supported by people who are working part-time doing that because they have full-time jobs. They don't get paid to you know, keep these libraries up to date. They did it because they were interested in that particular technology. In the case of UPnP, that developer had a full-time job doing something else, and so it took him a while to update that library. No fault of his own, you know, he had built it because out of need. But if companies are building on these technologies without full-time support, that's really going to affect the users. And the reality is most of these devices have these kind of libraries in them. And so if it's an ODM or a JDM that needs to fix it, it takes, you know, a month or so to get a build to the test team to even start working on it.
Right. But one of the problems is that these devices are kind of set and forget. It's not like your MacBook or your iPhone that's constantly alerting you when an update becomes available and really just annoying the heck out of you until you apply it. You know, you wouldn't be the wiser if there was a firmware update unless you took the specific action to connect to this device. And again, most people out there don't even know that these devices have interfaces that they can connect to, you know? I mean,
exactly. This really gets to the heart of the problem. And I've had this discussion with a lot of people over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, which is who's supposed to be responsible for security. And for years as security people, we've been trying to train people to be conscious of security. And I've argued that that's not our job. Our job is actually to make security easy so that consumers don't have to think about it. Part of, you know, and I spoke at Black Hat this year on a open source framework that we're releasing. And part of the impetus for that was put the security team in control of the security of the device, not the user. So the user doesn't have to think about if there's a problem, if there's an update that needs to happen. You know, they install that device. You're right. The great majority are never going to think about that device. So why not make sure that you protect that for them? You know, if there's a problem, you can remove the identity of that device and replace it. You know, you can make sure that it's only getting updates from where it should be getting updates from, that it can only communicate on the network with devices it should communicate with, and assume that the network, the devices, everything's compromised. So you always reassert identity. You're always reasserting that I'm allowed to talk to someone, because we know that this environment is compromised in many ways. So instead of assuming a perfect world, assume it's already compromised and prove it again and again that you're allowed to talk to someone, right? It becomes easier for a consumer if you say, do you want your door to talk to your lights so that when you open your door, your lights go on? Well, that's a very easy thing for a consumer to understand. But if you're asking, hey, should your fridge be able to look at your TV? You know, no consumer's going to say yes to that. And yet mm-hmm. what's happening right now in their network is every device can usually communicate with every device on their
mm-hmm.
network.
Mm-hmm.
The flawed model.
You know, again, there are going to be other auto-exploits that come out. We've talked here both about the lack of regulation and then also about some technology and maybe industry fixes. Where do you think things go from here, and where is the right fix? Is it a mix of regulation, tools, and industry effort, or does it lean more heavily on one of those than the other?
I think ultimately it's going to end up with regulation, although that's probably not the right solution. And the reason for that is if you look at PCI, you know, PCI was this certification that came out to make sure that you're doing the right things when you take credit cards. Unfortunately, if you look at every vendor that has been or every retailer that's been hacked, they had PCI certifications. Yeah. So it's a very low bar to pass. Is it a start? Yes, but it's not the solution we need. You know, I say that consumers really need to use their buying power, but that takes a big shift in consumer behavior before that happens. So I think it's probably going to end up being a combination. For a while, the Federal Trade Commission was going after companies that were putting in poor security, things like putting WEP into devices when we've all been told that WEP is something you shouldn't use anymore. The problem is that some of those cases they were very successful on, and some they weren't when they had big legal teams.
Yeah.
So I think Mirai changes the story a little bit. There will be others like that that will sort of get consumers to realize that their privacy, security, and safety can be at risk at times. But we have to be careful as security people to not scream about the sky is falling, because consumers are aware of that and they start to ignore us. So we have to be very careful about how we pose the risk. There was a project that I started a couple years ago along with I Am the Cavalry called the 5-star privacy, security, and safety rating. And it's something that we have worked on to try and get out. And there's a lot of people involved in reviewing it and updating it. But the original idea was very much how you buy a car. You know, some people, they go, they look at a car and you see a 5-star rating, or, you know, 1 to 5 stars. People don't really have to think about what goes behind, you know, what are the tests that are run. But most people would probably rather have a 5-star car than a 2-star car. And, you know, some people are willing to accept a 4- or 3-star car, you know, based on the price or that it meets their needs. But at least they understand that clearly a 5-star car is going to be safer for them. And what we tried to do with a similar model is say, here's how this manufacturer on this device is focused on privacy, safety, security, and things like, you know, secure updates and making sure that, permissions are done properly.
Right. It
also gives researchers a way to normalize their evaluations of devices. Rather than, you know, one researcher focused on one area, they can focus on a sort of model that says, you know, here's what we expect to be there, these kind of controls,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the right implementation of a control, because there's multiple ways to do it, but the control itself. And then you can look as a consumer, if people started putting these ratings on, to say, hey, this one gets a 5-star, this one gets a 4-star, I'm probably going to, you know, spend the $20 more maybe and get the 5-star device.
Right.
You know, that's something tough, obviously, to get manufacturers to put on. You know, maybe that ends up being a regulatory move. But ultimately, we need to provide that kind of information to consumers so they can make better choices.
Brian Knopf, Senior Director of Security Research and IoT Architect at Neustar, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, the European Commission released a new document last week to help explain the pending General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, to both business owners and consumers. It was just the latest official heads up from the Commission that come May 25th, there's a new sheriff in town when it comes to protecting personal information online. Our second guest this week, Sam Feifel of the International Association of Privacy Professionals, says that GDPR will be a rude awakening for many U.S. firms. Sam and I talk about what GDPR will mean for companies that store data on employees or customers, what kind of enforcement actions to expect, and how ready firms are to comply with the law.
Sam Feifel, and I'm the Director of Content at the IAPP. You know, I think what their guidance was mostly intended to do was give a kick in the pants to the member states who they would like to see put some more effort into awareness campaigns around the GDPR for this small to medium-sized enterprise community. I think most of the large companies at this point, you know, they've hired their $1,000 an hour lawyers, and their, you know, internal people have been poring over this for the last 2 years, and, you know, they kind of understand their obligations at this point, and they are, you know, deeply into operational response and, you know, figuring out what's going to actually have to change in terms of their IT systems and their policies and that sort of thing. But we know from plenty of research that's been released already that somewhere between 50, 60, 70% of small businesses just have no idea that GDPR is even a thing. And it's going to be really hard for them to get up to speed in time. And, you know, being a small business doesn't mean that you don't have lots of member data or lots of personal data. You've likely got, you know, you can be an app with, you know, 5 employees or something like that. And if you hit it right in the app store, you might have a million customers that you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
That's a serious risk and obligation. So for a lot of companies, going through that guidance that the commission put out and looking at those rights that, you know, I call them data subjects. It's a little bit privacy jargon. You can call it citizens or customers or consumers or whoever it is, the people that you do business with, they have very specific rights when it comes to their personal data. And especially for an American audience, I think there's some sort of general surprise there. You know, I think a lot of American companies, they think of the data they collect as theirs once they collect it.
Yeah.
And the GDPR sort of makes it very clear that the data isn't theirs in any way. They are only custodians of that data. It's almost like a license to use the data that their customers can take back at any time. And that's sort of, it's a philosophical change in thought that a lot of American companies are going to have to come around to if they want to keep doing business with European citizens.
Yeah, it's true. And we've seen this play out really even just in the last week, I would say, with the Strava exercise app, right?
Absolutely.
Where, you know, that got attention because the data was being used to kind of re-identify both soldiers and military facilities. But when you look at Strava's privacy policy, the basic setting, as they called it, was basically no privacy at all. You know, you share everything with everybody, at least everybody who's on Strava. And it did enable them to put together a pretty cool heat map. But looking ahead, when GDPR really takes effect, are we going to see the end of that type of profuse data sharing?
It really depends on what the customers see value in. What the GDPR changes is this idea of privacy by default, right? So it doesn't say that Strava can't collect your location data. It doesn't say that Strava can't then publish an aggregated map of all your location data, you know, that's pseudonymized in some way. What it says is that you have to ask my permission first, and that you can't put out an app that has all of the settings over to the collect side, right? You know, what's going to have to happen, and, you know, I'm not picking on Strava, so you take a, you know, any sort of generic app that needs location data to work correctly. Even something like Google Maps, you see, you know, Google Maps asks you, hey, do you want us to collect your location data? Is that okay? The reason they do that is because they've already kind of bought into privacy by default. Even though it seems stupid, why would I want to use, you know, Google Maps without you tracking my location? That's the whole point. I want you to know where I am and know how to get somewhere else. They still have to pick that default setting. So their default setting is don't track data. And I have to say, yes, it's okay for you to track my location. And what's going to be really weird is the notices that they have to provide when they ask for that consent now have to be much more detailed. You know, the GDPR says you got to tell me why you're going to use that data. You got to tell me how long you're going to store that data for. You have to tell me who I can contact if I want to end my permission for using that data. And, you know, how do you do that in a mobile setting? How do you do that with a Fitbit that's on your arm, right? How do you ask all those questions? How do you provide all that information? That's what's going to be really tricky for product designers. And there's just a big premium now on, you know, what we're calling kind of privacy engineers. And they're these sort of quasi security professionals, quasi privacy professionals who have to figure those things out, right? So how do we engineer a user interface that allows, you know, people to actually make good decisions about how you can use their data?
Hey, this is Paul from the Security Ledger. If you're hearing my voice now, it means that you're a loyal listener of the Security Ledger podcast. To thank you for listening, we've got a special Easter egg offering, a one-of-a-kind Security Ledger t-shirt with a cool custom IoT security-themed artwork. Quantities are limited. To get yours, just go to securityledger.com/t-shirt and fill out the order form. We'll ship it to you, and be sure to include the special code to qualify for the order. That is SLT2018. SLT as in Security Ledger, T as in T-shirt, 2018 as in it's 2018. So you work for the IAPP. This is an organization of privacy professionals. What changes do you see? I guess some people would say, gosh, this is probably a full employment act for privacy professionals. But what do you see? What changes do you see just within the profession?
Well, I mean, it is that in a lot of ways, right? So the GDPR quite literally has something called the Mandatory Data Protection Officer. And, you know, that's certainly been a boon to us. We've grown from 12,000 to 36,000 members in the last 4 years. So
wow,
it's certainly helped our organization grow quickly. But it's also because these people are desperate for information. There isn't a lot of details on the how in the GDPR, right? So it says that consumers have this right to be forgotten, say. They have the right to call me up at any time and say, hey, I want you to delete all the data that you have about me. That's not always that easy, depending on how large a company you are. You know, imagine if you're GE or if you're Walmart or if you're, you know, any variety of companies that have numerous locations, numerous points where you collect data. It's not like these companies have one giant master database. And it's not that I would want them to have one giant master database. That's kind of a honeypot. So, you know, figuring out where all that data is and making sure that this John Smith is not that John Smith, those are real technical issues. And so our members are working with their security and their IT departments to just figure out how you actually go about doing some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, you said, I mean, it certainly for many U.S. corporations, it's going to be a cold shower because the presumption here for years really is that your value as a company correlates directly with how much data you can aggregate and then figure out how to monetize, usually somewhere down the road, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, the old adage that, you know, if you can't figure out what the company's product is, it's you. does GDPR really mark the end of those days where, you know, the more data you have, the wealthier or more valuable you are as a company? Or again, is it really just more of a, well, there needs to be more process and controls, but that basic model will survive?
I think it survives. It depends on what the value proposition is, right? If the service that you're providing is worth what you want to do with my personal data, then you're all set. The GDPR doesn't change that at all. You know, if you're very explicit with your notice and you're very transparent about what you want to do, you know, people can either agree to use your service or not. You know, and I think Facebook is a great example. You know, if Facebook is, you know, I'm not personally a Facebook user, but there are, you know, my mother loves Facebook, loves, you know, seeing nieces and nephews and aunts and uncles on Facebook. And if Facebook is clear with her, hey, you know, we want to serve you some targeted ads so that, you know, when you go to L.L. Bean and look for L.L. Bean boots, we're also going to show you some L.L. Bean sweater vests. She'll think that's fine. She'll make that trade 9 times out of 10, you know. Mm-hmm. But if what you're offering is not good enough, then people will say, no, you know, I'm not going to use your service if that's what I need to give you.
Yeah.
So it's really just about transparency. And what the GDPR does is just make it very clear that that is a transaction. I am giving you my information to hold for a certain amount of time in exchange for these services. And as soon as these services don't please me anymore, you have to stop using my data.
So there's been a lot of focus on both sides of the Atlantic on the fines piece of GDPR. What are you advising your clients and members in so far in regard to GDPR compliance and the possibility or prospect of fines, especially in that first kind of 6 months after the May 25th cutover?
If you look at what the regulators are saying publicly, you know, the French regulator, the CNIL, or the ICO's office in the UK, they talk a lot about wanting to see an honest effort. They understand that many of these things are hard. I was at a conference last week where the Belgian Data Protection Authority admitted that his own office will not be GDPR compliant on May 25th. You know, they know how long it's going to take to fix their systems. They just had a new law put in place. They're going to have new commissioners in. It's just not possible for them. The regulators understand the complexity. What they are going to be enforcing against out of the gate are sort of, you know, people who are willfully out of compliance, people who haven't made an effort, right?
Kind of flaunting the law.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think what you'll see out of the gate are, you know, sweeps, like they call them, you know, where they'll take a class of apps or a class of websites. And I suspect them to be, you know, the sort of vulnerable class things, right? So websites in the health arena, websites in, you know, over here in Europe, your sort of labor union status is very tightly protected. Anything that collects that kind of data, things that are aimed at children. And they're going to do a sweep and they'll probably send out, you know, 350 letters to a variety of offenders saying, hey, in our first sweep, we have noticed that you are not in compliance. This is a fair warning. If you are not in compliance the next time we come calling, bad things are going to happen to you. They don't want to fine half of a class of businesses for ignorance. That doesn't protect privacy, actually. What protects privacy is getting people to protect privacy. And if they can do it by raising awareness all at once, getting people to make those changes, getting apps to be more privacy protective, That's what their goals are. Their goals are to make sure that people's data is being used in a respectful way. Then I think a little while down the line, whether it's 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever it is, you know, the fair warning will be done with, and they'll start picking out specific cases that they want to make a point with.
And in terms of the size of the fines, do we have any sense? I mean, the upper limit here, that 4% of turnover or 2% of turnover, depending on the violation, talking about global Fortune 500 companies, that could be a multi-billion dollar fine.
Sure, it could be. If you look at the guidance, so the Article 29 Working Party is the group of data protection authorities in Europe. They all kind of get together and they issue guidance together. They put out a guidance on regulatory fines, and they say it's going to be an assessment of a number of things, right? So, you know, was it a mistake? Then that's not going to trigger a big fine. You know, people make mistakes. They're going to say, hey, please correct this mistake. You know, they outline very clearly that many enforcement actions will invite no fine at all. However, if you are willfully negligent, they use that kind of word, or if you seem to have done something on purpose to test the limits, then the fines are going to be greater because, and this is a big point, you have intentionally infringed on people's rights and freedom. In the EU, privacy is a pretty big deal. It's in their charter of human rights. So if you have done something where, you know, I think the fine might be worth the extra business I'm going to get out of there, and you've sort of willfully infringed on people's rights and freedoms, that's going to make the regulators angry, and that's what's going to trigger the big fines. I don't think you'll see those out of the gate, because if you try to impose a big fine, you're going to get a big court battle generally. And I don't think regulators want to use up all of their time, energy, and resources on one or two cases as they're beginning the enforcement of the GDPR. I think what they're going to do is try to pick cases that will provide some definition, right? So we have some pretty ambiguous terms in the GDPR, things like the word unambiguous. What is unambiguous consent? What is explicit consent? They're going to want to try to pick some cases that will define some of those terms, so that there is some legal precedence, and so they can fine with some greater confidence down the road.
If you were advising a company, either, US or EU or somewhere else in the world, that maybe hasn't been as on top of this GDPR thing as it should have been, but they've read a bunch of headlines recently and it's now on their radar, what should they do? How can they triage this problem?
The first thing to do is some sort of data mapping and inventory exercise. You have to know what personal information you actually have. Especially in the US, we've kind of used this personally identifiable information definition for a while. And that's too targeted. You have to think of personal information much more broadly. It's any piece of information that might be able to identify a person directly. It's things like IP addresses. It's things like, 4 points of location data can identify a person with 75% accuracy. You know, it's understanding what is it that I have, right? And that's kind of your risk exposure. So, if you do your inventory and you find, we actually don't have a whole lot of personal information here, the GDPR is not going to be a problem for you. You can sort of start going forward and manage the collection of it as you go. If you discover that you have huge swaths of personal information and much of it is in unstructured databases, then you have to start attacking that, figure out what consent is attached to it. What have people said you can do with that data? And then, if you're of any sort of size, if personal data processing is core to your business, you need to hire a data protection officer. Not only is it the law with the GDPR, but also you need that person who's going to run point on this whole operation, right? Someone who's going to understand and communicate with marketing and HR and IT and security, all of their various obligations.
Sam Pfeiffer, thank you so much for taking the time to come in and speak to the Security Ledger podcast about GDPR.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Well, we'd love to have you back.
Anytime.
And finally, firms in North America can at least be forgiven for thinking GDPR doesn't apply to them. But Shane Nolan, the VP of Content, Consumer and Business Services at IDEA Ireland, said that doing so could come with a steep cost. As an executive at that country's inward investment agency, Nolan works closely with companies that do business in the EU. He stopped into the Security Ledger podcast to talk about how things are going in the lead up to GDPR, what the biggest compliance headaches are, and what the impact of the new law will be for both businesses and consumers.
So I'm Shane Nolan. I'm Vice President for Content, Consumer and Business Services at IDEA Ireland. So IDEA is the Irish government's inward investment agency. And IDEA is responsible for going out and engaging with companies as they expand internationally and then persuading them that Ireland is a good place for them to drop anchor to develop the European market.
So tell me, I know in the United States, where I am, there are many companies, I think, that are not up to step with GDPR, maybe figure casually that because it's a European regulation, it doesn't really apply to them. What is the situation on the ground there in Ireland? What types of steps do you see companies taking now to prepare for this May 25th go live deadline?
Most of our clients have already been through the discovery process, so they know where data is. Then, pretty much most of them have re-examined how they've obtained the data. They've reached out to the data subjects or in the process of to reconfirm consent. You know, most of the effort actually is going into data security, data protection, encryption, and employee training. And we find employee training was almost an afterthought for some companies. But, you know, for the companies that are most known for how they mine consumer data for insights, you know, they've had their act together the longest. Other companies, I think, have only realized recently that they can lock down their network, they can get consent, they can make sure everything is come up to date from a network and systems management perspective. But, you know, if one of their employees gives data to somebody else by accident, then, you know, they've breached the regulations. So there's a big employee training element of this as well. We see a few blind spots that some companies have. More companies that are about to move into Europe than ones who are already here, because I think the communications juggernaut around GDPR has been rolling around the European Union for quite a while. And in Ireland, both, you know, service providers and the regulator have been very active in communicating what the obligations are and the urgency of you know, getting your house in order. But in terms of kind of some US companies feel, well, you know, it's in Europe and we're here, so I'm okay. Whereas they might be providing services to European citizens and holding the data on servers in the US with no European infrastructure, like they're in the net, so to speak. Or we have companies who feel, I'm not going to, go to Europe, but I'm not going to have any footprint there, and I'm going to do my data compliance back in the US. And you say, well, actually, you know, you have to choose a lead regulator in the EU, and you have to prove that you have the minds and management of the data in the country where you deem to be your kind of lead supervisory authority. So, you know, you can't do regulatory shopping. You have to have substance there.
The fines in this case aren't on a per head basis. So even if you were inclined to think, well, we've only got, you know, 5% of our customer base in Europe, and therefore the fines will only be, 1/20th the size. That is not the way this is going to work.
No, 2-4% of global revenue, you know, and for some companies, that's a very, very big number. And for some companies, their net margins are probably a little over 4%. So, if they approach this badly or choose to ignore it, it could be have a massively detrimental effect on their profitability in any one year. And we have to wait and see how these breaches are dealt with to kind of understand what the standard is around fines.
And for consumers, I mean, you're an EU citizen, how will they see that GDPR is taking effect? What changes, if any, will they see in their online interactions?
I think they're going to see a lot more requests for consent over the next kind of 3 months on various platforms. I think as well, there's going to be a lot of scrutiny from privacy campaigners, post May 25th to make sure that, you know, online services and particularly those with a high profile are doing things properly. And if they're not, they'll be called out. And there are plenty of active campaigners and activists in this space. So, you know, even though the regulators are watchdogs, there are other watchdogs in the broader kind of data ecosystem. But, you know, interestingly enough, what we're hearing, you know, anecdotally from a number of US tech leaders is that this is probably going to be a global standard eventually, that the European Union is essentially exporting this standard. And if you solve for GDPR, you'll ultimately be solving for what's going to be a kind of globally accepted set of standards around data protection. So many would say, you know, in private conversation that this is the high road for regulation and, you know, provided everybody adheres to it, you know, it is a level playing field in terms of regulation.
And as you're looking at it, this is a fairly comprehensive data protection, data privacy law. What's the heaviest lift for organizations, let's say your, you know, enterprise organization in becoming compliant? What tends to be the most both resource and time intensive?
I think discovery is a big one, just to understand, like, where do you have consumer data?
That first,
if you don't know where you have it, you can't protect it. I think consent. I think, you know, if you're starting from scratch, then you just have consent built into, you know, most of your consumer interactions. And you'll probably be in a public cloud environment with, you know, browser-based UXs and no data sitting on devices under your control. But, you know, it's the transition really is what's most labor-intensive, and discovery certainly. And it's a function of the size of your organization and headcount and, you know, your existing data storage structures. Now, that might change. Like, there's a number of, well, a lot of companies are still very much just coming out of that phase of readiness. So I'm probably saying that because it's what we chat to people most about at the moment. Mm-hmm. Some of the kind of latter compliance obligations might be more commonplace as we get closer to May 25th.
Shane Nolan of IDA Ireland, thank you so much for coming on and speaking on the Security Ledger podcast.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you.